On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From the dawn of time, it appears, when the spirit moved them, humans have come out of their caves and thatched huts, cathedrals and Latin quarters, and danced with drums and horns and song for the heck of it, for God, for fun. And when they did, writes the provocative Barbara Ehrenreich, there was almost always more than just dancing going on. Public celebration, from carnival to saints' days to rock concerts, she says, is a path to joy and to power. People in the streets are bigger than themselves, more connected, and a challenge to the status quo, to hierarchy. It's time to party again, says Ehrenreich. Up next on Point, power, joy, and dancing in the streets with Barbara Ehrenreich. We'll hear later in this hour from Larry Harvey, founder and organizer of the famous Burning Man Festival in the Nevada desert, and from a key player in New Orleans' annual Mardi Gras celebration. But first, joining me now from New York is writer and social critic Barbara Ehrenreich. She's the author of 13 books, including the New York Times bestseller on low-wage work, Nickel and Dimed. Her new book is Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. Barbara Ehrenreich, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So here we are. We're accustomed to you looking to all kinds of progressive causes and subjects, and Barbara Ehrenreich is a fascinating writer and researcher and journalist and author, and now you're writing about dancing in the street, and you take us a little by surprise. Why this?
Well, I should explain first. I feel a little offensive, you know. I usually write about misery and suffering, right. And here I am writing about joy. But this started 9 years ago. And it grew out of, excuse me, Tom, a little bit of a cold. It grew out of a lot of reading I'd been doing about human bonding, community, solidarity, you know, the kind of the good side of human beings. And then I kind of came across this anthropological fact, which is that people, excuse me, all over the world have, at one time or another.
Take your time, Barbara. There you go.
Tom, you may have to help me out here for a bit.
Okay. Let me just say, while Barbara, you begin by going way, way, way back here for a sense of humans dancing, celebrating publicly with music and movement for a very long time. You see it as kind of integral to the expression of a part of human nature and maybe not expressed quite often enough these days. Give us some of that history, if you'd be good enough.
Well, you can find in rock art, going back 10,000 years ago, depictions of people in lines and in circles dancing. You know, that's a very, very old and common theme. If you go into the ancient world, if you go to ancient Greece, most religious celebrations, including the elements of dancing, music, feasting of some kind, and then you sort of put it together, and the anthropologists say that you have these ingredients, dance, music, feasting, which can include drinking, and costuming, masking, face painting, that those are the traditional techniques by which people have generated this kind of collective joy, whether in something they called a festivity or in a religious ritual.
With all kinds of dancing going along with that, and there's a history of tolerance and intolerance that goes along with that history. You describe great waves up and down of the public ready and willing and permitted to go out and do that robustly, and other times when it was either specifically put down by the powers that be or was simply outside the social norm. Give us a sense of some of those waves, if you would, Barbara.
Well, the overall pattern is of repression. Elites were threatened by these kinds of activities on the part of women in ancient Greece, who were worshippers of Dionysus, or the god of ecstasy, and on the part of the lower classes. So you have really a steady trend toward repression in the name of law and order, in the name of propriety, really, again and again. For example, the ancient Romans had their problem with, they saw it as a problem, the leaders, of Dionysian worship among women and men. And they responded to that with a crackdown every bit as ferocious as their later crackdown on Christians. In the Middle Ages, people were dancing in the Christian churches. They considered that to be a religious service, to be a danced ritual, until that was made a sin. You know, that there was a crackdown from the church hierarchy. Once the Protestants came along in Europe, they were the real killjoys. You get complete banning of festivities and the traditional Saints' Day celebrations and everything. Another case of repression, of the most huge and global, is that when Europeans fanned out around the world, colonizing, exploring, exterminating native peoples, they invariably were horrified by the indigenous danced rituals that they found, which would include, you know, the masks, the face painting, the whole thing.
All the things that Hollywood kind of exoticized and mocked itself for decades once it began to put its eye on that.
When did Hollywood do that?
Well, if you think about, the classic old picture of a guy in a big black pot, a missionary in a big black pot in Africa, or even the depiction of Native Americans in the kind of, isn't that dancing around the fire hilarious or exotic or strange?
Yeah, well, the Europeans were generally horrified by the spectacle of indigenous people dancing around a fire with face paint. And, you know, the Europeans thought it was lewd and obscene and, quote, savage. So, of course, they just had to wipe it out, although they were, you know, crushing indigenous religions and remarkably elaborated kinds of cultural things. Like, you know, those dance steps didn't come from nowhere. All the music, all the musical instruments, the costumes, all of this involved tremendous preparation. It wasn't just people going nuts on the spot, as the Europeans so often thought.
Barbara, you write about two different strands braided in here, one of joy and another of power. There's all kinds of paths to joy. What's the particular path to joy or ecstasy that you followed when you look back on all this public celebration, dancing in the streets? How is it different from any other kind of joy?
Well, there are all kinds of joy, you know, that we kind of experience as an individual. I suppose there's a lot of joy in skiing. We all have things like that. We don't need any other person involved. But there's a particular kind of thing that can happen in a group of people. They don't have to know each other even. If you have these ingredients of dancing and music and you generally food sharing and costuming, you know, we can just do that. And it's been done again and again and again. It seems to have, you know, it has a neurological basis. And I explore that a little bit in my book because that, you know, I'm a biologist by training. That fascinates me. And it seems it's probably involved with a subject that's gotten very popular in neuroscience now, and that's mirror neurons. That is, when we see another person moving, something in our brain gets ready to execute the same motions ourselves. You know, Tom, if we were together and I started doing some kind of rhythmic motion, there would be something in your brain
that would want to bob along.
Would want to start up doing it.
Right.
Yeah.
Which gets to a kind of collective joy as a distinctive kind of joy, and then very quickly to a kind of power, a kind of collective power that I read you describing embedded right in that, Barbara.
Yeah, because one of the things you experience in this is a sense of bonding with other people, a sense of solidarity. As one neuroscientist describes it, dance is the biotechnology of group formation. The ability to form large groups, groups that stayed together that were much larger than kin groups, is probably rests, according to the evolutionary biologists, on this ability to employ music and dance and food sharing to bring people together. And that was a big evolutionary advantage in terms of group defense. So we're kind of hardwired to get pleasure from these things because, you know, well, people were more likely to survive if they could hold together such large groupings.
And I'm guessing a progressive activist like you also looks at it and says there's a kind of politics that are more likely to survive when people are swaying together.
Well, you know, this is not a particularly political thing. It's not, you know, I think, let me think. I'm thinking of a really bad example here. Papa Doc Duvalier, the dictator of Haiti for many years, encouraged voodoo ecstatic danced rituals as part of his means of social control. It's not, it's not in all cases intrinsically something that lends itself to, quote, progressive or kindly forms of politics.
One illustration of the kind of thing perhaps we're talking about here comes from the 1984 movie Footloose. A Chicago boy moves to a small Midwest town. Here's a scene where Wren, the character played by Kevin Bacon, addresses a local town meeting begging the council members to allow a school dance.
My name is Wren McCormick, and I would like to move on behalf of most of the senior class of Beaumont High School that the law against public dancing within the town limits of Beaumont be abolished.
And the show's Reverend Shaw Moore, played by John Lithgow, explains why the town should not allow the dancing.
Besides the liquor and the drugs, which always seem to accompany such an event, the thing that distresses me even more, Wren, is the spiritual corruption that can be involved. These dances and this kind of music can be destructive. And, Wren, I'm afraid you're going to find that most of the people in our community are going to agree with me on this.
I do.
But before you know it, they get footloose. Barbara Ehrenreich says we could use more of that. Barbara, I wish you'd describe, whether contemporary or from history, a few of examples of the kind of public celebration you're talking about and the kind of impact they had, either in recorded understanding of public joy there or in terms of power of those in the streets.
Okay, you want sort of like political implications in terms of power?
Any way you like it, but you're saying it's important, it has impact. Give us some examples.
Well, European Carnival, which was the sort of Mardi Gras celebration, although there were similar festivities throughout the church calendar, that would be a time for all these activities would go on. And in late medieval Europe, those often tipped over into uprisings against the powers that be. The French Revolution was shot through with carnivalesque activities, and there was even a distinct dance that went with the revolution. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, the Carmagnol, and people, you know, linked arms. So these are not couple dances we're talking about. Mm-hmm. They linked arms and danced across fields and hills and throughout whole towns. Those would be some examples. The movie excerpt, was making me laugh, was probably referring to coming to the early days of rock and roll, like the 1950s, early 60s, I don't know. But, you know, that was there's a whole chapter in my book on that because rock and roll was there was a kind of a rock rebellion in the 50s where at concerts where everybody's supposed to sit still, kids didn't sit still. They leaped up out of their seats. They danced in the aisles. Cops would be brought in because, of course, this is disorderly rioting, and stuff them back in their seats. And then they just jump up again and again and, you know, and often out into the streets, too. That's just saying, no, we're not going to be spectators anymore because, you know, modern society's substitute for the festivities and dance rituals of the past has been the spectacle. You watch someone else dance or sing or act or dress up. You sit. And people, you know, have rejected that at times. That happens at sports events. This fascinates me. I'm not a big sports fan, but I'm a sports fan. You know, at a certain point in the 1980s in America, you found people costuming to go to sporting events.
And still in a resplendent glory, all kinds of face paint and chest paint.
Cheese heads,
you name it. Yeah, right. So is that the same thing? I mean, we just saw just over this weekend, you know, teams fighting to go to the Super Bowl, stadiums packed with people in outlandish costumes and yelling and doing the wave. Is that what you're talking about? Is that the collective joy?
Yeah, the wave is kind of an elementary form of dance. Now, if we were in Latin America at a soccer game, people would have drums in the bleachers and would be actually dancing in the bleachers. But we have managed, sports fans in America, in North America too, have kind of carnivalized sporting events, again, refusing to just be a spectator.
You write, urbanization and the rise of a competitive market-based economy favored a more anxious and isolated sort of person, potentially prone to depression and distrustful of communal pleasures. That's a very large claim. What do you see having gone on there?
Well, I'm talking about the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, something happening in Europe that struck me. I was, at least a little nervous about how to link it to the decline of festivities. But there it was, a veritable epidemic of what the physicians at the time called melancholy, and which, you know, as more you study it, it looks like what we would call depression. And so how was that? It had to be connected, I thought. I think that finally concluded the connection is this, that there was a rise in depression going on, though we can't quantify it. But it was because it rose at the time because people no longer had those festivities and danced rituals, which are traditional cures for depression.
So are you saying
that's how they're used in many societies?
When you project forward, and you do, saying there's not enough of this today, despite the things that do go on out there, are you saying we'd be prescribing less Prozac if we were doing more dancing in the streets? Is that the claim?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it's a pretty safe bet, because you know one of the hallmarks of depression is isolation, a sense of being isolated from other people. Unworthy, unconnected, and that's what these sorts of rituals and festivities very immediately physically cure. They connect you.
Barbara Ehrenreich is with us. Her new book is Dancing in the Streets. You can join us at 800-423-TALK. And Barbara, a lot of people want to do just that. Let me go to Rhody calling from Boston. Hi, Rhody. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're great. What do you know?
Actually, I was trying to call in earlier during the New Orleans segment, but it turns out that the comment that I wanted to make directly pertains to this segment in terms of people just sort of getting together and celebrating in the streets. When I was home in New Orleans in November, I actually got a chance to go to a parade that was given by one of the social clubs. It was the Buck Jumpers Social Club Parade, and it's off of the Mardi Gras schedule, but this is a social club that's been in existence for 30 years, and they have a parade every year. And local people look forward to the social club parades more than the Mardi Gras parade, which is more of a tourist-type scene.
And, Rhody, were people moving and grooving in the streets, and was it lifting spirits?
And it does not go up the main thoroughfares. It actually snakes through the neighborhoods. And so the Buck Jumpers go through uptown New Orleans, and they have designated stops, and some people will wait at a particular stop and drink and eat, and then they'll join in the street, and then they'll follow the parade however, you know, they're capable of following after they've been drinking and meeting with friends and things like that. And so people who hadn't seen each other since before the storm, people travel from out of state to go to this parade who wouldn't come back for the Mardi Gras parade. And this is something that the people do. And the social club is also a big part of the culture. And so Rebirth Jazz Band did the music, and this is something that people who live there know is going to take place every year. And it seemed to me like it was just what people needed to deal with, just the constant stress and depression and anger and frustration that I saw when I was there, and it's still ongoing, people trying to deal with that situation, but it was definitely something that the people needed.
Rhody, we've got it, a real tonic there in New Orleans, dancing in the street. We appreciate your call. Barbara Ehrenreich, the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, says, you don't mention Mardi Gras in your book. How could you ignore New Orleans, they ask.
I think I mentioned it, but I also think it's a bit commercialized. And I agree with Rhody, the real action in New Orleans, from my point of view, the much more authentic thing is what are usually called second line celebrations, such as what she described, that are organized to the extent they are organized by social clubs or by small store owners or something, and that's what I want to get to. So I promise. New Orleans, for anybody who's there, I want to come, and I want to come not just for Mardi Gras. I want to be part of one of those second-line celebrations.
New Orleans is eager to have you do that. I mean, they feel, I'm hearing all over, that they fit right into, when you write, the urge to transform one's appearance, to dance outdoors, to mock the powerful, and embrace perfect strangers is not easy to suppress. A lot of voices in New Orleans saying that's what our celebrations are all about. I want to turn to one of them right now, if I may. From New Orleans, Curtis Pierre is with us. He's founder and director of the Casa Samba School of Afro-Brazilian Dance in New Orleans. He's also a parade coordinator for the Endymion Coronation at Mardi Gras, one of the largest carnival parade crews there. Curtis Pierre, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
When Barbara Ehrenreich says public celebration, dancing in the streets, is important for the soul of a people. Have you seen that in New Orleans?
Well, just to reiterate what she's saying about how festivities make people feel well, what I'm dealing with is samba. And I researched the meaning of samba, and samba means to express a large amount of self-expression and joy within yourself. And that's like, you know, the epitome of what carnival is, and self-expression, and how people can all do this together. And I also heard mention earlier about the power that brings together. And when you have a whole bunch of people feeling good about something, that sure does bring a lot of people together.
Curtis, when you see all that individual expression performed collectively in the streets, does it create something bigger than all the individual creativity going on there?
Well, that's another thing I want to, you know, about the... I have always been a big fan of not commercializing carnival and things like that, until I participated in a carnival in Rio de Janeiro, where I was among hundreds of people that I had to actually prove myself as not a Brazilian player, but as a part of the people of the samba school. And I did a lot of work there. I helped them do a lot of things, and that kind of made me feel, you know, really a part of an organization where the commercialization of it, of the big 14 big schools in Rio, that kind of dissipated when I saw how much joy that I got from being with these people and expressing what they express and feeling what they feel and coming home again, which I have been doing that, and getting a different look on the situation, because it is very commercial here, but it involves so many local people, and that's what makes it more incredible.
Barbara, you describe a scene on the beach in Rio with a samba class, I guess, underway, that you found pretty moving.
Yeah, I was in Rio, actually on sort of business. It wasn't vacation, but with my son, we heard drumming one afternoon. There was a whole phalanx of dancers coming down the street, samba dancers. We learned it was a samba school rehearsing for carnival. They were people from like 4 years old to 80 years old, dancing with perfect dignity, some costumes, some not. When they got to the beach itself, other people just began to join in. And it was something so unself-conscious about it. You know, I kept thinking, boy, in so much of my country, people have to be drunk to do that. It was, to me, a flash of what life could be like, you know, this little vision, the kind of thing Curtis is describing happening sort of sounds spontaneously, but a ground samba.
Curtis Pierre in New Orleans at the Casa Samba School, thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Mm-hmm.
I want to take a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and Ginger, if I may. Hi, Ginger. You're on the air.
Thanks. Good morning. How are you?
We're great. What do you see? What do you know?
Oh, what do I know? Well, I'm a big fan of Barbara's books, particularly Nickel and Dime.
Yep.
I don't know how many times I loaned out my copy of that one.
Right.
So wonderful. I've yet to read the latest one. I wanted to tell you about a picture that I cut out of the newspaper here in Tennessee about a year ago. I don't even know what football game it was, who the people were, but someone had taken a candid photo of people who had just broken into dancing, and it was just the happiest and most joyful picture I've ever seen.
What was the setting, Ginger? What was going on where they were dancing?
It was the parking lot of a football stadium, and like I said, I don't recall if it was the Titans or if it was a college game or whatever, but it was just the most wonderful picture. And, you know, I don't often read the newspaper in the morning and sit there and break into a big smile.
Ginger, when was the last time you danced in public, in the streets, let's say?
In the streets?
Or...
Oh, let's see, not too many.
Or even a parking lot.
Well, I'm a pretty joyful person myself, so that's not the rarity for me.
Yeah.
But anyway, I cut that picture out, put it on my refrigerator, and kept it there for months. And any time I needed a smile, I just looked at it.
And speaking to you, Ginger, thanks for that. Thanks for the call. Barbara, you're not a sports fan, you say, but a fan of fans. So maybe that's where the load of collective joy is carried these days in the USA.
I think a lot of it is. And remember, rock and roll is a big part of sports events today, too. So the difference between a sports event and a rock concert has narrowed a lot. I mean, look at Super Bowl. I did tune in to watch the Rolling Stones last year at halftime. It looked just like a rock concert to me. But, you know, some people are really using the games, you know, not because they really care who wins or even who's playing that much, but because this is a sanctioned situation for collective joy.
And just as good in your book as any other, or are you still making the criticism here that it's a little too framed by, I don't know, the ads on the scoreboard and the ticket, the price of admission?
Well, that's a big problem, is that the people who sort of carnivalized games were working class people. The kind of people like the Cleveland Browns fans that Susan Faludi wrote so beautifully about in her book Stiffed, or working class soccer fans in Europe. Now it's too expensive. You can't go to those games unless you're pretty affluent. I mean, people do save up to go. And also there's this kind of class hierarchy within them, with the rich in their skyboxes where, God forbid, they should have to mingle with face-painted, wave
those
dancing
those sweaty, beer-swilling hoi polloi.
Yeah.
I want to invite into our conversation from San Francisco, if I may, Barbara, a really important voice on this very front. Larry Harvey is with us. He's founder and organizer of Burning Man, the big festival that takes place every year out in the Black Rock Desert in Nevada. It's just grown and grown and grown. You may have seen the photograph, if you haven't been there yourself, of that great Burning Man sculpture that burns every year. Larry Harvey, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. So you're here and perhaps have read a bit of what Barbara Ehrenreich is talking about, saying we're not getting enough dancing in the street, public celebration. Is that what you're trying to provide an antidote to at Burning Man?
In part, it sure is. When it comes to rhythm of foot, Black Rock City is rife with dancing. We have our the city we inscribe on the desert floor every year has about at least 30 miles of street front, and there's hardly a square foot of that area that doesn't see spontaneous dancing during the course of our eight-day event.
35,000 participants there in the desert. The city, as you describe it, is kind of laid out on the desert floor. 35,000 people there last year. That's a lot. Larry, what do people come looking for at Burning Man?
Well, they a number of things. For many, it's a spiritual gathering. For others, it's a big party. The two aren't mutually contradictory. They come looking for belonging is what they stay for. They often come looking for a celebration, and they stay because they discover a community.
And we hear a little bit of it behind us right now. Is there, Barbara writes about a kind of power that can emerge in this kind of gathering. Do you feel that power when you're at Burning Man, Larry?
It's hard not to feel it. You hear it. In some cases, sound will vibrate through your body, If anything, one of the challenges is to escape it from time to time. I live in an airstream when I'm out there, and because you, when you're out in the city, it's difficult to escape.
Sounds almost like the ocean roaring there with the sound of Burning Man in our ear. Barbara, what do you make of this expression of public joy, celebration? It's all the way out in the middle of the desert. Does that count?
Oh, yeah. No, it's wonderful. I think one of the amazing things is that we have these things that pop up after all these centuries of repression, the creativity that goes into Burning Man, and it's not just the musical aspect, but many other artistic aspects of it, too. But we have the transformation, and I give the gay culture here a lot of credit, the transformation of Halloween more into a grown-up holiday. An example, the Berlin Love Parade, which can have up to 1 million people on the streets in that city, dancing all day for days to different bands and costuming and painting themselves and so on. These are things that just spring up. I mean, there's something in us that cannot be suppressed forever.
Larry Harvey, you've created something amazing there in the desert at Burning Man. We thank you for joining us for a few minutes today.
Thanks.
Let me go to Gene in Rhinebeck, New York. Gene Fleming, I think, who organizes the annual Halloween parade in Greenwich Village.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi, it's great to have you, Gene. Barbara Ehrenreich loves the Love Parade in Berlin. What about your Halloween parade right there in New York City?
Well, I mean, certainly in New York City, we're not losing that spirit. This is a free, non-commercial event that has 60,000 people in it and 2 million, of course, watching it. And for the last 28 years, I've been blessed to sort of midwife this thing into being.
And take us there. For those who haven't been, describe the scene, Gene.
Well, the wonder of the Halloween parade is that it's, I call it a new American holiday for the new American family, in the sense that it's the only time you don't have to go home on a holiday. You can celebrate with your friends, who are the family that you live with day to day. It's a celebration of the individual imagination brought into the collective. And it's extraordinary for its scale and the fact that it's still a totally open event. Anyone can join who's in costume.
It is a
huge trance dance, really, mm-hmm. for all the people who are in it.
And do you feel, Gene, like an outlier with your big party in the streets there? Barbara Ehrenreich says we're suffering a shortage of this kind of public expression. Do you feel that?
I think that's true. I think we are suffering a shortage of it, but certainly not in New York City. We're so blessed. And largely it's because the city is brilliant. It recognizes the value of this as a spiritual and healing event for the city. Most cities on Halloween are dangerous places. New York City is safe on Halloween. It's partly the brilliance of the police department in the way that they allow this to freely go through the streets of New York City with virtually no restriction.
Gene Fleming, it sounds like a great party. Barbara, it sounds right up your alley.
I've got to go. But I would disagree a little bit with Gene. I still don't think we have enough, even in New York City. If you compare, for example, to 15th century France, where 1 out of 4 days of the year, not counting Sundays, was given over to some kind of outdoor festivity. I mean, we are trapped in a culture that says you get up every morning and work. What is much more natural and human is to get up in the morning and work on how you're going to play next. And we've kind of really, I say one day of the year is not enough for your parade. I want your parade, 6 or 7 times a year.
Gene, could you handle it every 4 or 5 days?
I would love to do it, and that's actually how I spend my life. I'm a celebration artist, and what I do is create opportunities and for communities to experience that joy, the ecstatic coming together through music and dance. That's what I do all my life. So the Halloween Parade is one of 15 events I do a year.
That's great. Party on, Gene Fleming, and thanks for being with us.
I'd like to just mention something about the healing aspect of an event like that. After 9/11 and certainly after Katrina, the Halloween Parade became an extraordinary opportunity for the healing of a community. People weren't on the streets. It was dead. People were evacuated to New York City, and they were lost in hotels. We did a second line for both of those occurrences in our history where people were allowed to come out and publicly mourn and change from the sadness of the event into the joy of collective.
A healing thread there as well. Jean, thanks very much for being with us. Let me take a call from Jason in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi. Wonderful program. Thanks. I am sort of an insurrection type of drummer. I've always enjoyed playing outside. I've been an artist and a musician forever. And one of the places that, the longest standing gig was playing Beatles music in Harvard Square. And why we kept doing that is because the people kept coming. We'd be out there every month of the year, all kinds of weather. And, any time that a kid wanted to come up and bang a drum, I'd let him. And it was just a gathering place for all kinds of ages of people that you wouldn't see playing in clubs.
And is it just fun, or does it matter in some other way, Jason?
Well, it was really deep. The longer and longer I played that music, I began to understand the heart in it and why people kept coming. And I would have people tell me they were, like, depressed. They didn't know what to do. And a woman who became a good friend, said she'd sit there for hours and just go away feeling better. We had people who changed their flight back to France because they wanted to stay in here, hear more music that made them feel good.
Well, that's pretty great. Jason, keep on drumming. And let me get another call here, if I may, from Amherst, Massachusetts. Ellen is on the line. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
I am. Hi, Ellen. How are you?
Ellen, meet Barbara. Barbara, meet Ellen. What do you know, Ellen?
Well, first I want to applaud Barbara on writing the book. I think there is so little written about community dance. And it's very exciting that she's researched this, and I look forward to reading the book. I teach sacred circle dance. I've been trained at the Fintorn Foundation in Scotland.
What is it, and sacred circle dancing, Ellen?
Sacred circle dance was founded by a German dance master named Bernard Wosian back in the late 60s. And he and his daughter Gabriella believed that a lot of these village dances were leaving the planet because of, occupation, the things that were happening in the Eastern Bloc of Europe. So he gathered the music and some of the steps and put together a repertoire of dances that are based on a lot of these ancient, village dances, like Ora Sevilla, which is the dance of life, which is, a Macedonian dance that's celebrated in the village spontaneously.
And do you see it pulling something out of people that just doesn't emerge easily otherwise, Ellen?
What we believe in the sacred circle dance movement is that these dances are encoded in our DNA. And when you join hands and begin to dance collectively in a community, something is awakened. There is a remembering of this code, and people feel this. And that's why I think there's a resurgence to come together and dance. And in teaching, in my own experience, I was hired by the Newburyport Mass Middle School to bring dance into their sixth grade program. And we happened to be dancing the Friday after Columbine happened. And these children came together, and we were able to dance. I mean, you can't say prayer in public school, but we talked about energy. And they felt that they had really sent something and connected with this group. After 9/11, in the Market Square of Newburyport, over 150 people came to the village center to be together and to hold on in a very simple dance to create community around these
events. A dance and a kind of healing again there. Ellen, thanks for your call. Barbara, we're getting lots of calls from people who have found ways in their own lives to pursue exactly what you're talking about. Is it possible that it's not quite as rare as you might think?
No, it's interesting to me that, in the week or two since the book has come out, and I've talked on a radio, talked to groups around the country, I find out so many things I didn't know about, like this sacred circle dance that Ellen just talked about. I find that, in California, I suppose it's not so surprising, but, groups of people who have danced worship that they've created on Sundays. I don't mean traditional Pentecostal forms of worship, but, new kinds.
Do you discount traditional
kinds? Yeah, there is a lot happening.
But I have to say, when I get home to the Midwest, I sometimes go with my sister-in-law to her church service. It's a kind of praise service. There is a lot of singing and moving in the aisles going on there. Do you count that in your public celebration?
Oh, yeah.
I guess I have to ask, do you discount it? Because there's a lot of that these days.
I'm not saying that these things have been entirely removed. I'm just saying given their once centrality in human affairs, they are much more marginal. The more ecstatic types of worship, for example, in this country, tend to be in the storefront Pentecostal churches. You know, they don't tend to be in the mega churches, or certainly not in the main line.
This church is in a former liquor store by the highway next to a trailer court, and those people really move, let me tell you.
Well, you see, that's the historical, you know, kind of linkage of class, the more downtrodden people being those who had the more exciting collective experiences.
Let me go to Michael in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
We're great. What do you know?
Well, what I do know is that I've been associated with music and dance all my life. My father was a musician. My mother was a musician. Little background, my mother lived out in the country, had nine brothers and sisters, and they sang on the front porch. The whole county would come over and party, you know, and dance.
It sounds like barn dance country.
Yeah, and my father played for barn dances. My earliest remembrances are of him playing what they called minstrel dances, where they blackened their faces and played. And I've noticed through the years, I'm now 50, went on 59 years old, that people have become steadily more inhibited about expressing joy and dance and becoming free. It seems to me now that people have to become intoxicated in order to be able to express themselves and dance.
And Michael, what's lost when we lose that freedom, that sense of freedom to express in dance and music publicly?
Well, all I know is that that people are more jaded than they used to be, and everything seems to be more professional. You can't be just a dancer or just a musician. You have to be a professional musician. And they don't get together on their back porch or their front porch and dance and play like they used to. Our society has developed into the point that people feel inhibited unless they're a professional.
Michael, we've got it. We very much appreciate your call. Barbara Ehrenreich, we've just got a couple of minutes here. Let's say people weren't so inhibited. There were more chances. They were on their porch, in their barn, in their urban street, wherever, singing, dancing. What do you think the impact would be over time if we had more of that, Barbara?
Well, I'm not saying it would bring about world peace and solve all problems. I wouldn't make that kind of claims. But I will say this very serious thing about it. You know, we have an environmental crisis in our world. We cannot keep meeting or deflecting our needs into just material objects, more cars, more gadgets, more things that we own. We're going to have to find some other ways to happiness. And I think here it is. It's right in front of us. Doesn't require a whole lot of stuff. Doesn't require that we buy a whole lot. Although I guess you could invest a lot in sound systems and things.
Feathers.
But, you know, but rather low technology ways of making ourselves really happy, as I think most objects do not make us. And beyond really happy, something that no object can provide, and that is ecstatic states. And so I hold this out, you know, in a serious way, as, you know, we can think about a future with a lot less waste and material consumption, but more joy.
More joy sounds good to me. Barbara Ehrenreich, you always bring us a big new view, and we're grateful for it. The new book is Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. Barbara, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. We'll go out with Martha Reeves and the Vandellas, Dancing in the Streets. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.